Welcome to another UCTV.tv podcast presented by University of California Television.
No one is better equipped to be an eyewitness to global warming than Will Steiger. For nearly half a century, he's been exploring the polar regions, experiencing firsthand the effect of global warming on indigenous cultures, wildlife habitat, and Arctic topography. Will is one of those rare persons who bridges two usually separate worlds, one of extreme adventure, the other of environmental education. Think Al Gore on a dog sled. Actually, that strains credulity. Will is an explorer who has truly gone where few have gone before, and largely by dog sled, canoe, and kayak. He has returned not only to fuel the fantasies of armchair adventurers like myself, but also to tell us of a polar world whose magnificent ice caps are rapidly turning to water. This has made him a legend in the league of Amelia Earhart, Robert Peary, Roald Amundsen, and Jacques-Yves Cousteau, all of whom, with Will, have received the National Geographic Society's John Oliver LaGorse Medal for, and I read, and I quote, accomplishments in geographic exploration, in the sciences, and for public service to advance international understanding. Recounting Will's life of adventure can leave one exhausted, not to mention shivering, in amazement. His early explorations began with a 3,000-mile kayak trip from southern Alberta to northern Alaska in 1964. As of today, he's logged some 15,000 miles by kayak through Alaska, Canada, and the United States. But Will is best known for having led some of the most significant feats in the history of dog sled expeditions. These include the first confirmed solo dog sled journey to the North Pole without resupply, a 1,600-mile south-north traverse of Greenland, the longest unsupported dog sled expedition in history, the historic 3,500 first-ever dog sled traverse of Antarctica, the first and only dog sled traverse of the Arctic Ocean from Russia to Canada's Ellesmere Island, and a solo expedition from the North Pole. During these expeditions, he pioneered online education, reaching tens of millions of students via online daily journals, including the first ever transmission of digital photography from the North Pole. Last year, Will led an expedition to Baffin Island to study the effects of global warming. This year included an expedition to Ellesmere Island to study the receding ice sheets, along with a Greenland kite ski expedition to document rising summer thaw levels and changes in the ice sheet. His plans for the coming year include a kite ski expedition through western Antarctica. My plans include driving to Goleta after this program. Last year, in 2006, Will established a foundation to foster international leadership and cooperation on global warming by promoting environmental education and policy. The Foundation's Global Warming 101 initiative seeks to engage individuals and policymakers, teaching them how to translate their climate concerns into action. His educational initiatives draw on his vast experience to make the abstract notion of global warming immediate, bringing it home to today's policymakers and the young people who inherit their parents' rapidly deteriorating planet. Will Steiger has taught science at the secondary level, founded a winter school, and developed an innovative wilderness program in Ely, Minnesota. He established the Global Center for Environmental Education at Hamline University in St. Paul and the World School for Adventure Learning at the University of St. Thomas. He holds a Bachelor of Science in Geology and a Master of Arts in Education, in addition to honorary doctorates. He is the author of 4 books chronicling his adventures as well as the effects of environmental change. And last year, he received National Geographic Adventures Lifetime Achievement Award. It is truly an honor to introduce Will Steiger, an eyewitness to global warming, Please join me in giving him a warm but polar-friendly Santa Barbara welcome. Will Steger.
Okay. Yep. Thank you, Richard, for the fine introduction. I, too, want to thank Jenny Hunter, my long friend, and for making this possible, and everybody for coming out tonight, the folks here at Santa Barbara. I'm not new to Santa Barbara. I used to take my summer vacations here in the 70s and 80s in the June to get away from the bugs of northern Minnesota, so it's a great town here. I often get the question of how do you get involved in exploration, and maybe my Minnesota roots might answer some of that, but I was raised in the city of Minneapolis, but I really have to thank my parents. I'm from a large family, 9 kids. My dad was an entrepreneur. Yeah, I was raised pretty much with that type of spirit. As kids, we never had rules in the family. As long as we got a certain grade point average and we stayed out of trouble with the law, we could basically do whatever we wanted to as long as we paid for it. So my first book that I read in third grade was The Adventures of Huck Finn, and that book actually kind of crystallized a vision of adventure and meeting people along the river. And I had always been fascinated by the Mississippi River that runs between Minneapolis and St. Paul. And when I was 12 years old, I used to caddy and cut lawns. I bought an old wooden boat and a motor, and I fixed that up, and all winter I worked on that. And when I was 13, I traded that in with a little bit more work. And by the time I was 15, three more trade-ins, I had a pretty decent boat, and I took that down the Mississippi River with my older brother, who was 17, from Minneapolis to New Orleans and back. And that was my first and last motorized adventure. I was in debt for a couple years after that, paying for the gas money. And I started climbing when I was 16. In Minnesota, no one climbed. I checked a book out of the library called Mountaineering Freedom of the Hills and bought a hemp rope out of a hardware store and started top rope climbing at some of the cliffs there in Lake Superior. And from there, I started kayaking. And I've had a very fortunate life of I've always known since a child I wanted to be involved in education. I always had a dear concern for the environment and the innocence. And also, I always had that freedom of exploration that I think I got from the freedom my parents gave me. And I started doing major expeditions at a very young year. I all through my high school, college, and my teaching, I taught junior high science in the late 60s. I taught actually global warming in the early 60s, and there I branched out, and Richard told you some of my other background. Tonight I want to show you some of the eyewitness accounts of what I've seen in the Arctic. Traveled there for about 40 years. The scientists 15 years ago said we'd see the first changes in the polar regions, and since these areas are so isolated, very few people have seen these, and unfortunately there have not been enough eyewitness account of it, but I've seen it firsthand, and especially the acceleration, incredible, the last 5 years. It's really quite shocking, but I think through my presentation tonight, I can give you a planetary perspective of the seriousness of the problem that we're talking about, and then we'll do some questions and answers that I can maybe pick it up with some solutions and so forth. But I first of all want to take you on a expedition across Antarctica to give you an idea what expeditions are about and how we organize them. I use the pointer here. This is an international team, 6 people from 6 countries. In 1989, we crossed Antarctica, the longest possible route, 3,700 miles. We had a couple glaciologists, Dr. Qin Daohuo from China. He received the Nobel Peace Prize with Al Gore a year ago, last December. He was a co-chair of the IPCC, which was the international body of climatologists. Dr. Viktor Boyarsky, climatologist from St. Petersburg, Russia, there at the Arctic Antarctic Institute. My partner was Dr. Jean-Louis Etienne, a Frenchman from Paris, France, who I had met on the way to the North Pole 3 years before. My other team members included Jeff Summers, who worked with the British Antarctic Survey in the 80s. British Antarctic Survey is the scientific arm of the polar studies in England. And Jeffrey was in charge of the dogs back in the days when they used dogs for support of the expedition. So Jeffrey had a great deal of not only dog experience, he was very familiar with the Antarctic Peninsula. And then Keizo Funatsu from Japan, another person of great qualifications. So we had a special breed of dogs that we bred especially for this expedition. We call it a polar husky. They're a cross of many northern breeds, the Canadian and Greenland Eskimo dog, the Mackenzie husky, some of the Yukon dogs in Alaska. Essentially, these dogs are weighed around 85, 90 pounds. They had this incredible racing-type drive, a spirit to them. Very strong bodies. Their fur is super thick. Their ideal temperature is 30, 40 below zero. The overheat at zero, you know, if it's above, right at zero on a clear day, you have to be very careful of the dogs because they will overheat. But they're a pack animal. I mean, they're raised in families and are very well adjusted. And they live for these expeditions, so they're well adapted to the rigors of the trip. This is Antarctica. I purposely chose this route because it was the longest. Prior to this, 13 men, the Scott, Amundsen, Mawson era, had penetrated the interior. Only six of those men returned. Antarctica is an incredibly harsh area, especially in the high elevations. We had to leave in midwinter in order to do this expedition, July 15th, on northern Antarctic Peninsula. No one had ever crossed this, been in the peninsula before in the winter, and we found out why. We crossed the Larsen Ice Shelf, which I'll talk about in a minute. That was the first section here. Then we, throughout the mountains here, we had a 56-day storm, incredible storm that we barely survived. As we got further into the interior, we distanced ourselves from the storms. We got into really super cold weather. And then on to the South Pole. And then we crossed this area here, the area of inaccessibility. Had never been crossed before, never been seen. Human experience had never been there. And 222 days later, we managed to reach the Russian research station of Mirny. Now, Antarctica is divided into two geographic halves. This first area here, the longer, the bigger high plateau here is eastern Antarctica. This is a plateau 10,000 to 11,000 feet high, the coldest place on the Earth. Very deep ice. Some of it goes down 14,000 feet. The oldest ice in the world. Some of it's older than 800,000 years. Now, since this is such a massive plateau, it creates its own weather system, and the interior of Antarctica has not been changed yet from global warming. We're starting to see changes along the fringes, but what has scientists very concerned is this ice sheet here called the Western Antarctica Ice Sheet. This is a little bit different. It's called a marine ice sheet. It extends below the ocean. It's frozen below the ocean, but these marine ice shelves are also backed up by what's called, these marine ice sheets are backed up by ice shelves. This is called the Ross Ice Shelf. Ice shelves float on the water. They're basically almost like an extension of the ice cap going out over to the ocean. It's about 1,000 feet thick. But they buttress against Western Antarctica. Western Antarctica are almost predominantly surrounded by these ice shelves like this. But since they're at sea level, they're extremely vulnerable to climate change, especially a rise of temperature. And we're starting to see a change of these ice shelves. If these ice shelves disintegrate, what happens is it's almost like turning a cork, a wine bottle on its end, pulling the cork out. The wine flows out real quickly, so they dam up against the continental. This I'm going to show you in a second here. The northern Antarctic Peninsula will be this shot here. And what we're looking at here is a mountain range, high mountain range, around 7,000, 8,000 feet. And then this flatter area here is called the Larsen Ice Shelf. There's the smaller Larsen A Ice Shelf, about 80 miles across, a mountain range, and the larger Larsen B Ice Shelf. This took us 31 days to cross. I mean, this is how immense it is. Both these ice shelves have since disintegrated. And I'll show you in a few minutes the disintegration of the on satellite photos of the Larsen B. But I first wanted to show you what the Larsen Ice Shelf looked like before it disintegrated. These pictures are, in a way, historical because this ice that you're looking at, this ice shelf that's about 700 years old, 700 feet thick, 12,000 years old, no longer exists. I normally travel on large polar expeditions with teams of six, with 30 dogs broken up into three dog teams, 10 dogs. In other words, we have three dog teams, 10 dogs each, sled that at the beginning of an expedition will weigh up to 1,200 pounds, maybe supplies between 40 and 45 days with the supplies of fuel, available fuel and food and clothing and radio and so forth. And then two people live off the sled. In other words, our tent units are in there. So we have these three separate tent units, totally self-sufficient. In case we lose an entire sled unit or two sled units in a crevasse, for example, we still could survive. We travel on skis all the time. We don't ride. There isn't a place to ride on the sled, even if you wanted to, for a couple reasons. For one, the only way you keep warm is by movement, and we do a 10-hour day. Normally travel 10 straight days. One day off, and then if you ride, you also wear out the dogs. So this is the best arrangement with 10 dogs, three dog teams like this. This is the Larsen AI shelf here, mountain range that separates these two bodies here. We crossed about a dozen mountain ranges along the way. This was our first We had, as you're going up and down, of course, you have and glaciers, you have crevasses. We're always roped up in these type of situations. We all had considerable experience, not only in cold weather, but climbing experience. But it's a little bit different traveling in the mountains like this with dog teams, a little more trickier. This is one of the big dangers that we faced were these huge crevasses. This one, of course, was very obvious. Ice bridge had collapsed probably a month before. It gave us a good photo opportunity. But you can see the consequences here if the bridge did collapse. It could swallow a team or two teams. The problem is that most of these huge voids like this were covered with ice bridges of ice, snow that drifted over. Clear weather, you can see these by small, thin ribbons, kind of grayish ribbons in front of you. You always knew, you can tell there's crevasses underneath here, but in whiteout conditions, you have to probe ahead. You don't see here in the picture, there's a couple team members with roped up probing ahead, checking. We were very fortunate. We didn't have any major incidents, snow, didn't lose any sleds. Several of the dogs went in, but they were tied in through their harness systems, and just a matter of pulling them up again. We were up at high elevation 6 out of the 7 months, between 7 and 11,000 feet. But at high elevation, we had extreme wind chills. Average wind chill 60 to 80 below zero. We dressed like space people. You couldn't expose skin at this. Fingers would freeze instantly. But you get used to traveling like this. It's almost like being outer space in a way. But it's amazing how adjusted the human spirit is. I mean, you really adapt to this. You don't really, after a while, you always have to be on the guard, but you're not thinking that much. And traveling like this, you're never, 99.5% of the time, you're very relaxed. It's seldom that you're fearful or anything. The crevasses are a little adrenaline rush, but we had these big storms that were quite dangerous. But it's just pretty much just a way of traveling. Coming down to the Larsen B ice shelf, we had our first short storm, pretty mild for Antarctic standards since it was sea level, about 50-mile-an-hour winds, 30 below zero. In these storms, the dogs curl up in tight little balls. They cover up their faces with their tails, and within 20 minutes, half an hour, they're totally covered by the snow. And like an hour after you make camp, if you look outside from your tent, you don't see the dogs at all. They're all underneath the snow. They're extremely warm. They can breathe quite easily in the light snow, but extremely bored. They wait for the storm to end, and this one was a short storm. Two days later, we're out of the tent, and the dogs are always waiting for the sound of footsteps in the snow. They can't hear the wind, but they can hear the sound of a footstep, and as soon as you step outside, the dogs start popping up from underneath the snow all over, and they're very happy to get going. I mean, you think these dogs are just an incredible spirit. There's always a few dogs that stay closer to the tent, or the sleds, and they get buried in deeper drifts. We relocate them and get them dug out, and they're ready to go here. This is the Larsen B ice shelf. This is what an ice shelf looks like. Flat, absolutely perfect travel, perfect conditions, no elevation problems, very few, if any, crevasses. Every ice shelf that I've traveled on in my career has disintegrated. The Larsen A and B. In the northern hemisphere, the Isles ice shelf that broke up 3 years ago, the Ward Hunt ice shelf that broke up this summer, the Markham ice shelf that broke up also this summer. But I wanted to show you here, Larsen. This is the Larsen B, what it looks like and before it collapsed. This is, again, just a refresher of the distance here, 350 miles, get a size, 31 days of travel. Notice this mountain range here. That'll be our reference point right here in this next slide. This is in January of 2002, 6 years ago. This is the mountain range right here. Notice Larsen A is gone. That disintegrated in 1998. And this is here is right the day before the Larsen broke up. What you're looking at here is the Larsen ice shelf. It's about 150 miles from the ocean to these glaciers. These are some of the longest glaciers in the world. Now, as long as the ice shelf's in place, the glaciers are moving at a glacial pace of several meters a year. What happened here, 2002 was a record warm year on the Antarctic Peninsula, probably for the first time in 12,000 years. A large quantity of snow and ice melted on the surface, forming huge lakes. All these striations, these dots, are big lakes. And when you get water on top of ice, it's a problem because that water then trickles through the cracks and the fissures of the ice, which changes the structure of the ice. In northern Minnesota, when you're ice fishing, 8 inches of solid ice you can drive a truck on. But if that ice gets wet, the truck will go right through. It totally changes the structure. And this is what happened on a planetary scale. The water destructuralized the ice. On February 1st, 2002, we had the first collapse on the south end. These are the size of small New England states here. And that caused a chain reaction that went on, what went on for the next, I'll redo this, oops, get back here. This chain reaction went on for a whole month, and this entire ice shelf completely collapsed into the ocean. Now, the scary part about this is it caught the scientists by surprise. The scientists have been actually quite accurate in their predictions. They've been actually on the conservative sides, but they had no idea that an ice shelf half the size of Maine could just suddenly disintegrate. And this is the scary thing about global warming, because you have these sudden thermodynamic changes that instantly change it. Now, with the ice shelf disintegrated, it was floating on the ocean, so you didn't see a sea level rise. But with it gone now, these long glaciers, these glaciers now are surging very quickly in the ocean. And that's where we're going to start seeing the sea level rise. The Ross Ice Shelf that I showed you, if that disintegrated, we'd see a rapid rise to sea level. This is just a, you know, minuscule, very slow, but it's the beginning of something that's in process that we really need to take action with the carbon dioxide that I'll talk about. This is the top of the Greenland ice cap, the second largest green ice cap in the world. This is 10,000 feet high. In 1988, we crossed that south-north 1,600 miles as a training for Antarctica. No one had ever run dogs for any extended period at 10,000 feet, so we felt we wanted to do this a trip like this. We also needed to see exactly how far could we go if we didn't, we weren't resupplied. We also worked on diet and a number of things, team dynamics. But to get a sense, we went 60 straight days like this on this immense area. This is Greenland here. Some of you may have flown from it's between North America, of course, and Europe. Your flights to Europe sometimes fly over this area. This is 1992, again, 1,600 miles across here. Contains about 12% of the world's fresh water locked up in ice, and if that went in the water, broke up, it's stable still, except for some problems near the edges, we'd see a sea level rise of around 24 feet. Now, what you're looking at here in 1992, the red areas are the summer thaw levels. In other words, the thawing level here went up to about 700 feet in 92, not a major incident. This is 10 years later. We had a thawing level now going up to 3,000 feet. You can almost visualize this. The Arctic is really rapidly warming, and that warmer weather gets higher and higher in the ice caps. Now, this is 3 years later. Notice it's up to 5,000 feet. Unfortunately, you don't have the slide for 07, but the 07 warming thawing level went up to 7,000 feet. Now, again, 5,000 feet of ice is not going to melt in a short summer season, but the problem here, again, is water. You have a rapid runoff, huge amounts of water, more water than that goes off out of the Amazon River in the summer flows off the Greenland ice cap. And unfortunately, this water doesn't flow to the ocean. It flows, it gathers in creeks and streams and rivers, and then flows right into holes and crevasses, which then flows underneath the glaciers, which lubricates these massive ice sheets as they flow into the ocean. So what you have here then is a massive surging of glaciers into the ocean. The last 3 years, we've had a huge amount of ice going into the ocean. It was so violent at times, it showed up on the Richter scale, 0.6 and 7 on the Richter scale. Richard, mentioned that we crossed Greenland last year, and we crossed Greenland east to west by kite ski. This is during the summer. We didn't travel by dogs, but by kites and skis. This is large kites that are about 125 feet, lines that are attached to us. We're on Telemark downhill skis. We were training here right on the eastern ice cap here. We're getting ready to cross the main ice shelf here. We're training, kind of getting in shape, getting our kites and gear set up. It's a really beautiful way of traveling. We travel with sleds. The sleds weigh around 200 pounds. In Antarctica, you can travel 1,500 to 2,000 miles totally unsupported. So you can go totally unsupported into areas that are virtually almost unexplored. You have this belt around you. You put on regular skis, nothing unusual, Telemark skis. And then you attach your line here. The back line goes into your harness. There's not a very big wind, as you can see, about 7-8 mile an hour wind. And then you get ready to launch the kite. Even in a small wind like this, you can do quite well in distances. And you launch it like this and off you go. So we started off then. We went up to about 8,000 feet on the ice cap. And you can see how we travel here. It's pretty efficient. This is up about 7,000 feet, very quiet. When the wind blows, you travel anywhere from 24 hours to 36 hours straight. Sometimes because the wind stops, you rest. See, you can control the kite with your arms. The kite itself is snapped into your harness. You have helmets because you can, if you overpower, you can get dragged or pulled into the air and then dumped on your head. So it's a fall in this sport is very memorable. And this is a crosswind here, which is very easy. And this is now going up over the ice cap. You can see how we traveled here. But then we got down on the western side at 6,400 feet. We started running into running water. It was right here. This is mid-July, July 15th. And this is probably the first time ever we had flowing water at this elevation, you know, probably for 100,000 years. The streams weren't that large at first. We could still get across with our sleds. But as we got further down at 5,400 feet, we start getting larger streams. And like this, running water. And then these streams gain more momentum into larger streams. And at 5,000 feet, we were totally stopped. We couldn't go any further. And later we were, hear that sound? You never hear the sound. This is global warming, and this is on ice cap. This is supposed to be frozen. We were picked up by a plane, a Twin Otter on skis, and flew over. And I'll notice this is a large river, half a mile wide, flowing on the ice shelf. Look what happens to it. See, it disappears, goes underneath the ice. Here's another huge one. This is, I mean, you just have to see it for yourself. We flew over at 3,000 feet on the way back. You could still see way down these streamlets, but you can't get an idea unless you travel foot by foot the immensity of this and what this means. I mean, if you study glaciology as in geology, this is the edge of the ice sheet here. This goes on and on, this calving. Calving is normal, but not to this incredible extent here. This is like a 12, 14-story building here lifting into the air and tipping on its side like this. I mean, this is the rise of the sea level that we're starting to see now. Scientists say we have to reduce our carbon emissions 80% by 2050, but it's right now reducing, you know, making that immediate change right now. The main goal here is really to try to stabilize the climate enough so that we can manage the sea level rise that's starting. Scientists talk also, there's several other things that you need to be concerned with. And one is the what's called the permafrost, and this we'll show this here. This is the North Pole here, Arctic Ocean, larger than the United States. North Pole, normally a thin layer of ice, about 6 feet now in the winter, over 15,000 feet of water. So it's 3 miles deep of water at the pole. Surrounding the Arctic Ocean is Eurasia and North America. These white areas are permafrost, permanently frozen ground, 3 million square miles of permanently frozen swamp and bog. Now, as long as the swamp and bog is totally frozen, it, of course, does not interact with the atmosphere. But what we're now starting to see, and you're reading it in the papers, you're starting to see the thawing in the summer of the permafrost. You're having some major structural problems in Alaska. You have two villages on the western Alaska here, they're totally collapsing into the ocean, almost totally gone. Pipelines that are starting to become destable, roads, buildings, everything that's built on this permafrost are starting to change at a very infrastructure, very expensive. But on the environmental side, it's something just as serious, because as this permafrost starts thawing, when organic material gets above 32, it starts decomposing. And when it decomposes, it gives off carbon dioxide and methane. And methane is a 21 times more dangerous greenhouse gas than carbon dioxide. And this is extremely serious, because once this starts in process, it's called a feedback loop. You get more and more methane, and it gets cyclical. It gets more and more. The permafrost looks like this in the wintertime. It's hard to tell if you're on ground or lake or swamp. In the summertime, it's really quite obvious. You have dogs. The dogs here, if you dig down here, there's maybe 8 or 12 inches of moss, and then the frozen ground, you hit the ground right underneath that. That's the permafrost. This is what the scientists, or this is the present rate of permafrost. The green here is very deep bog, hundreds of feet thick. Normal situation as it is now. Scientists are predicting if we continue, you know, business as usual, emitting the same amount of carbon dioxide as we have right now, in 50 years we'd lose 50% of the permafrost. This would be catastrophic. This would be, we'd be on the fast track to losing all the ice in the world, about 280-foot sea level rise, I should say. So this would be, and I really don't think that. I'm sure that we're going to get control on our emissions. But if we continue it another 50 years, this is the seriousness. We would lose 90% of that, which would be a Cretaceous dinosaur era. So if you see here, you can almost visualize the methane is locked into plant materials, frozen, not interacting. But as it thaws, where does it go? It changes into a gaseous material, methane, into the atmosphere, which increases the warming. This is the top of the world. This is what I consider the tipping point. The northern part of, north of the Arctic Circle has been up until 20 years ago, mostly snow and ice with a short summer season. But the Arctic Ocean itself and the surrounding ice, which is a huge, huge area, has been covered 90 to 95% ice even in the summertime. Now, the issue here is that you get 24-hour light and the polar regions for 150 days. So that's a heck of a lot of solar radiation constantly hitting the globe. That's more radiation than what strikes the tropical areas. But now as it starts warming, you're starting to get some of that sea ice is starting to melt. And as it melts, of course, it exposes warmer water or darker water, darker land surfaces, and then you get more absorption. And this is what's starting to happen. Up until recently, the last 7,000 years, we've had a relatively stable climate. Now, within that stable climate, you get lots of natural variations. But if you look at the 700,000-year record, it's probably the longest, warmer, stable area of what we've had in 700,000 years, if you look at the ice core records of Antarctica and Greenland. And that's enabled us as a species to evolve through agriculture and so forth. But now that's starting to change. I want to show you, I have a short clip. We crossed the Arctic Ocean in 1995 from this island to the pole down to Canada. And on this picture, you'll be a helicopter coming in, and then we start moving on the ice here. We basically run the dogs all the way across, lots of open water. And we get this close to Canada, the ice starts is too dangerous to continue on dog sleds, which we anticipated. There the dogs are flown out, and you'll see pictures of us hauling these canoes to get over the ice and into the water. So I'll see if we can run this, and I'll narrate over this as we go. This is the Russian helicopter. This is 54 below zero. Perfect temperature for us because this ice is moving all the time. You want it to be super cold to keep the ice from moving. Now, notice this is moving ice. You can actually see it moving. You can hear the noise. It's almost like a wooden ship that's being crushed. This is typical of the Arctic Ocean. It's real dynamic. It's not moving that you can't get away from it. And there's a couple features on the Arctic Ocean. Big pressure ridges where these big plates of ice come together and you have to chop. You're basically a road construction crew. But in the 90s, we started seeing incredible changes. Open water, temperatures 20 to 30 degrees warmer, some areas in the summer, which made it extremely difficult to get dogs over this area. These two plates of ice now are starting to separate. And we're trying to get the dogs across here before one sled gets isolated on the other side. So there's a little bit of urgency here. And dogs are trained to keep going, to kind of short-circuit their natural tendency of panicking. There's a lot of open water right where the dogs are jumping here. I was always the last of the three here. Ice is the worst, but he's out of perspective. Totally open water here, but you just kind of go over it like that. And you've got a 1,000-pound sled. You don't want to drop it in the water. And this is on the Canadian side. Dogs are flown out, canoe sleds, which are a lot of work.
Stop. Okay. Now.
Here she comes. Yeah.
Patience is a very important thing of an explorer here. 30, 40 miles of this at a time. And then open water like this. This is where the canoes were great, because you couldn't travel like this with dogs. Extremely cold water. I mean, if you fell in here, it'd be pretty serious. We're in dry suits. We got clothing over it. And this is coming into northern Ellesmere. Actually, this is the Isles Ice Shelf coming into it. That broke off, as I mentioned, in 2005. Well, this is what we're seeing. I talked about the tipping point. the Arctic Ocean. 20 years ago, up until 20 years ago, mostly snow and ice, a little bit of thawing in the summer, but 98% of that energy that hits ice reflects back off, up, and that's, you know, keeps the Earth cool. This is what it was in the 90s, where we started to get a little bit more thawing. This is what's called a positive feedback loop. In other words, global warming first starts the thawing of the ice. Okay, the ice starts thawing, and then that causes its own feedback. In other words, more thawing, more absorption, and this process starts. This situation, 3 years ago, the scientists were predicting a century or a century and a half from now. This happened last year. Last year, there was an incredible breakup of the multi-year ice on the Arctic Ocean. We lost 50% of the sea ice on the Arctic Ocean, which was, it shocked scientists. It just, they couldn't see it. I thought it was coming, but I didn't, I think I had a better clue than the science models, but I thought maybe this would be 20, 25 years, but it happened last summer. But this is the change of the heat balance here. This situation, scientists 3 years ago were saying 2 centuries from now. They're now saying 10 years from now. In fact, what the Navy is saying, I mean, I work with the Norwegians, the Scandinavian countries. The navies are preparing for a sea route to cross the Arctic Ocean in another 10 years from now. They figure they'll have a four-month season of going over. You've heard about the Northwest Passage, you know. They won't even use the Northwest Passage. There's no reason to go through Canadian territory and all the rocks and all this, but so the sea lanes are actually going to open up. But this is what I call, I think, what I would consider the tipping point. It's called an albedo flip, where you go from a reflective surface to an absorptive surface. And this is quite a serious thing. This will show you summer sea ice of 1979. This is in the September. This is a little misleading because this is broken ice, maybe 70% chopped ice, but this is totally solid ice. This is 2005, you know, 25% of it. This was the big breakup last year, 2007. And of course, we've got our beloved polar bear, the icon of the Arctic. This bear, of course, relies on the sea ice to make a living. It hunts what's called the ring seal. The ring seal lives on the ice in the summertime, and the only way the bear can get the seal is to track down and hunt the bear on the ice. If the ice is gone, the seal cannot catch the seal. The bear can't catch the seal in the water. So we're looking at a situation here with the bear on thin ice, but at the same time, humanity's on thin ice. Last year, for the first time, demand outstripped supply of our energy. We started seeing that as spike prices rising. We also very aware now, finally, what we do have a serious security issue here, relying on 70% of foreign governments for petroleum. And most of those governments are not very friendly to us, Iraq and Venezuela, to name a few. And then we just had the financial collapse here 3 weeks ago. And I believe the only way this economy is going to come back together, and I believe it will come together, but it's going to take a little bit of time, but it'll be around the new energy transformation. What we need here is a real serious effort, not just, we need it to be put against the wall, I think, like this. Americans are really good at moving when their backs are against the wall. We saw that in Apollo project, that was fairly minor, but the World War II effort that we had where we retooled an entire economy. Well, we're going to have a very similar thing. The great thing about this is the new green economy and the new jobs from the new energy sources, technology, energy efficiencies are all jobs that can be made in this country. The wind, the solar, all this technology, we send out over close to $1 trillion a year that goes from our hard-earned money out to foreign governments. In the future, as we become more energy self-sufficient, that money will recycle into the economy. It's really jump-starting this new economy. Like I mentioned, the scientists say we need to reduce 80% by 2050. That's a long-range plan. But it's really right now when we're all part of a economy and we're all beneficiaries of this great time that we've had up until now of cheap energy. It's given us the edge on other countries, competitive edge over the other countries. I mean, we're 3% of the population that consumes 25% of the resources. But now that's changing because of the costs, and we all know the reality of it. But I think there's a silver lining to this economic issues because I think, like I said, I think the real issue was the green jobs and moving in that direction. We can talk about a little bit about that through our questions and answers here. I want to keep us on time. I just returned from an expedition in Northern Ellesmere Island. I'll show you here. Northern Ellesmere, the Arctic Ocean's here. Alaska here for your reference in Greenland. Northern Ellesmere is this island here. I'll show you a close-up of it here. And I led a team of six 21 to 28-year-olds from four countries. These weren't the ordinary young person off the street. These are seasoned explorers, some of the best dog mushers in the country, in the world, some of the best kiters in the world. They all had a considerable experience in the Arctic. We got along fine. Our goal was we left Resolute, and we were going to dog sled up these islands to the last remaining ice shelves. But unfortunately, unexpectedly, the ice of the Arctic Ocean broke up here last year, and all this broken up ice was jammed in by major storms all the way through here, through this whole 700 miles, which is normally a really flat area. So we did manage to make it up here, but we did make it to some of the ice shelves. We wanted to make it to the Ward Hunt and the Markham ice shelf that did collapse a couple months after our expeditions. But I have a short little video here where I'm summarizing about that expedition. I talk a little bit about the Will Steger Foundation. Our foundation is basically, we through education and raising awareness, we drive policy. In other words, we drive the constituency. We make a populist movement into driving policy, making it popular for elected officials, or if the elected officials don't cooperate, they don't get voted in anymore in Minnesota, which I think they do here also in California. But I want to run this to show, it gives you a little bit of history of that trip, and after that I'll do some questions.
When you see the changes like we saw, the collapse of the Arctic Ocean and traveling on that sea ice that broke up, and this was the tipping point, the Arctic Ocean broke up, all this ice went down into the area that we were traveling in. And to experience that firsthand, it does change your life, changes your perspective. And I think it has a tendency of making people more committed. Our goal is we had several goals. One, we wanted to bring our audience to the front lines of global warming. We did that mainly through the websites, a little bit through the media. And not only working with our six emerging leaders were basically our conduit to that generation. It wasn't just for their sake, but it was the way to reach the younger generation, of course, is through their peer group. And so we wanted to bring the eyewitness account. Our main goal, though, was to really inspire people into action. And other than showing, okay, this is a real disaster here, look at what's happening, the need that we need to really take this on in a real positive way, look at alternative ways, or ways that we can change our lifestyle for the better. And also increase our quality of life. And so we hope through the project and through the ongoing efforts that we're doing is to inspire people to really take action, because unless we really take action in our personal lives and in our own circle of influence, you know, it's a great entertainment, it's a great project, but it doesn't get anywhere. One of the major successes of the team is just incredibly molded together, great, great friends. Success of an expedition could be in different ways. And first of all, look at a team. Did we set a good example? We want people to cooperate and get along and take this on in a very positive light. The team did really well.
It's 40 below here.
We didn't make our ultimate objectives of the ice shelves because we were stopped by this unexpected ice that plugged away. But that was, in a way, I felt very fortunate to have traveled through that and actually saw that ourselves. It wasn't just straight awareness and education. A lot of the work we do is policy. We want to drive our lawmakers, both Republicans and Democrats, into the right direction here and making good decisions, and especially in the policy level. So our work is a lot to do with policy. That's ongoing. So if you inspire several million people, especially the younger generation, and they're moving forward, and that helps us on our policy work. So it's an ongoing, it's an investment that you put in, and it keeps growing. It isn't just one expedition, but it's an ongoing effort to get the move policy through general education and inspiration of people. Yeah, we came back first day. We were in New York City, believe it or not, and we met Al Gore that one of the second evening that we were there. And I asked him. I'd worked with Al in the 80s on the climate change issues before. and asked him about the ice, and he was very familiar with that. He said that was the breakup of the Arctic Ocean. And he did give us some the top ice scientists that we called up, and they confirmed. And they were actually curious to get our sort of boots on the ground analysis of what we saw, because they observed this through satellite photos, but no one had ever been on the ground there to observe that. I think I'm sure that we were the first ones to travel through it.
Will's going to the Arctic and showing what's actually happening now, I think, makes the message much clearer. We can talk about the science, about the theory, but you need to see what is really happening, and that is what he shows so wonderfully. And also, he is successful in getting young people and educators, and that's what we have to do, so that the next generation realizes what is at stake. And I think the combination of the science and the explorer part is what is very effective.
You know, the younger generation gets so serious that when they're my age, the world is going to be totally different. Unfortunately, the start of the great sea level rise is already starting. I think we've already reached that tipping point where we still have some control in the next 10 years if we take it seriously. If we can level off our carbon emissions, that will be a major victory for the human race. But even if we do that, when carbon dioxide gets into the atmosphere, a majority of that stays for 100 years. So we're going to see some major changes. But it's not that we don't have solutions. We have a lot of solutions. The whole issue here is to get the younger generation has really got to take ownership of this and speak out about it, organize.
Okay. See the last. Great. Let me just, we can do some questions in a minute. Let me just talk, because I always get the question, what do we do? I think the first step, we've got to take this on in our own lives personally. We've got to look at ourselves, not expect our leaders to lead the way for us. We really have to take initiative ourselves. And that's, first of all, in our personal life, our habits, we can look at that, what we can do to curb carbon dioxide. I mean, energy prices, Minnesota, the electrical price, electricity is going up 17% this year, and in Minneapolis, it's going to go up 33% in the next 3 years. So cheap energy is gone. But we got to look at, so it's not just global warming and doing the right thing, it's how are we going to, you know, save ourselves money. So these conservation goes hand in hand. So in our personal life, just our habits and what we, and you know, I don't have to give you the 10 steps to do it. You should know that, or get on the website, or check out our website, globalwarming101.com. But from there, though, we really need to engage, because we all have a tremendous amount of influence from our friends, from the community that we belong with, our congregations, our schools, wherever we work with, we can organize, connect with other people. And that's what I'm seeing that's going on. In Minnesota, we totally changed the political landscape there in the last 2-3 years. The state that was kind of slow in the draw on this, although, you know, we always have a good name for doing good things up there, but it's amazing. I started working in the conservative churches. I went where the resistance was the most, the conservative areas and schools and so forth. But in the churches, they caught on to the moral issues, and it's amazing how they organized. And around that, once we got the electorate organized, we drove the elected officials, the conservative officials on our side, on the conservative, you know, I would say the environmental conservative side. And from there, we really, really changed the landscape. We have to do this from bottom up and top down, because we all can't do it alone, but we also have to engage. And we've got to get our elected officials engaged. And I'm hoping on this next election coming up a week from tomorrow that we're going to see some real, real honest change here. I'm very hopeful that things will go in the right direction. On a Will Steger Foundation, we do not take, we're nonpartisan. We don't take sides, which is sometimes real hard to do, but it's good discipline. But we really keep in the middle. What we're seeing in Minnesota and the Midwest is global warming and the global warming solutions are drawing both sides in together. It's really incredible how our state is becoming unified and our surrounding states around this area, and I think it might be happening here. So there's some very good things. I've been working on global warming for over 30 years. It's been a tough battle. But 4 years ago, I decided to leave my home in the wilderness and to work full-time on this because I really felt the time was now. I moved to the city of Minneapolis and started my nonprofit. But at that time, I kind of struggled how to get, where were the solutions? And I realized that the major problem was that our society was socially disengaged. There's a book called Bowling Alone, which was an inspiration to me 3 or 4 years ago. It talked about social engagement. I was from the 50s, 60s generation when we were re-engaged as a society, and then during the 70s and 80s, we became disengaged for various reasons. We can blame a number of things for that, I guess. But through global warming, I think we're starting to see it here, the fact that we're drawing a big audience. In the Midwest, we draw thousands of people on a regular time. But it's this engagement now that's getting around it, which is really the positive thing. Well, why don't we, I'm going to keep it on time. Maybe we can do 10 minutes or so of questions if we can get some lights in the back of the room.
You mentioned that behind closed doors, scientists will talk about the truth of the matter. And I understand that there's a desire not to shock people into non-action. But I'm wondering if you could comment on two things. One is the notion that perhaps we need a little more shock therapy to get us out of our apathy and our obsession with the economic downturn. And also, if you could put that in light of your experience with you know, speaking with younger people and yep. what their reaction is.
Good, thanks. I'll conclude with that. I think we got the shock therapy that we needed 3 weeks ago when the markets collapsed. I think we were living, as we found out, too high in the hog with too many cars in the garages, and this has changed. We have no sense yet of what this means, but it's trickling down. I run a nonprofit with 6 people, and two of the men that work for me, one on the website, one on the media, and their wives are the real breadwinners, which allow them to work for a nonprofit. They both got their notices today that they've got 2 more weeks. And so we're in a little bit of a problem, and we haven't felt that yet. But the way out of that, again, we also, as I mentioned, the security issue of relying on foreign oil. But the way out of that is going to be start building this economy around our jobs and so forth, which is going to take some time. But I think we got the shock therapy that we needed. Hopefully we won't get too many natural disasters. I mean, Galveston got wiped off the face of the earth. It was incredible. It's huge. It wasn't like an isolated storm, but it was immense. And it wiped out another city. Now, are they going to rebuild there? I mean, I wouldn't buy a property in Galveston or New Orleans. New Orleans is a doomed city, that whole coastline. So, you know, hopefully we won't get too many natural disasters like that. But I think the economic slap in the face here is going to be a wake-up call. It's going to be a tough one. But I think we're going to excel in that in the long run. In terms of the youth, that's where I have my chips. It's not just K-12 education. It's this incredible movement that's going on. It's in Minnesota. It's the Midwest. Obama's tapped into that energy. This generation from basically juniors in high school up where you can start organizing up to the upper 20s is incredible generation, really well socially interconnected. They're almost like my when I was in 60s generation, socially minded, the ability to organize. What we needed was a galvanized voice for global warming of tens of millions of generations saying, this is our issue. I used to lobby Senate and Congress 4 years ago. It was really uphill battle with these. I used to get arguments in the offices with these guys. And there it was just trying to inform them that global warming was real. But I would always bring in a couple real articulate young people. And in these arguments, the young people would always say, how about me? I am really concerned. And it always make the room silent. But we need this generation to step forward because this is your issue. It's your opportunity. It's also quite amazing what's happening. I've never seen anything like this. The fourth, fifth, sixth, seventh graders I'm seeing around the country, these kids are just incredible, reorganized. I mean, they're excited. They know all about global warming. I always tell them, teach their parents and teach their parents' friends. You know, I tell them, this is a different situation. Your parents and your teacher, your adults used to teach you. This is a situation where you've got to teach them. So it's really, and our organizing that we're doing in the Midwest, colleges, high schools, our events, we have politicians lining up to come to speak, business people that want to, this never happened before. So that's my hope, is this galvanized voice. And I do think the 60s generation that are now in their 50s and going into the 60s, I think there's a real natural coming together of the two generations. I see that happen. I wouldn't count my generation out on the count of 10 yet, but I think what's happening is my generation, I think, will take a more responsible role, a purposeful role, because when you work all your life for 65 years and then you're retiring and sitting by the swimming pool drinking your gin and tonic, you know, it's a little bit more in life than counting your time down. And I think my generation are worldly enough to know that and aching in their heart that there has to be more purpose than chasing the buck and a life of luxury. So I think a purposeful life, I'm seeing that happening a lot, of my generation going back into service, public service. And so I'm very hopeful about the movement. But I'll conclude by saying the changes are accelerating in the Arctic, and you're seeing them accelerate now. So time is now to get ourselves and our communities to be positive about this. And I think above all, we really have to be tolerant of people with different views of ours and have patience, even if their views offend us. Just be patient, because you'll win them over. I mean, you know, you sometimes got to cut your hair and wear a suit and tie, but you'll eventually get them on your side if you're tolerant. So, okay, I'll be around. Anyone wants to come up, talk, I got all evening here. Thank you.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.